the country's southwest. The MEK had joined the Iraqi operations since the early years of the war, but this time it wanted its own members to perform the operation. The Iraqi regime had provided 7,500 members of the terror cult with modern weapons and military equipment. The new strategy aimed to win the support of the Iranian people and establish an MEK-run puppet regime in Tehran, but to no avail. Iranian people regard the MEK members as invasive aggressors, so they responded to them by live fire. It was a surprise attack, as it occurred just days after Tehran and Baghdad accepted a UN resolution that ended the war and the front line was relatively calm. However, Saddam's ill intentions were met by fierce resistance from the Iranian people and armed forces. Iran's military launched a counterattack codenamed Operation Mersad and foiled the MEK operation just within 3 days by inflicting nearly 5,000 casualties on the terrorist group's members. Operation Mersad is of the essence in the region's history, as it is the last battle during the Iraqi-imposed war on Iran. It dashed Saddam's hopes of defeating Iran and thwarted the MEK's sinister ambitions. The MEK, now based in Albania, has carried out numerous terrorist attacks against Iranian civilians and government officials since the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979. Out of nearly 17,000 Iranians killed in terrorist attacks over the past 4 decades, about 12,000 have fallen victim to the MEK's acts of terror. The European Union, Canada, the United States, and Japan had previously listed the MEK as a terrorist organization. In 2012, the group was taken off the U.S. list of terrorist organizations. The EU followed suit, removing the group from its list of terrorist organizations. Washington and its allies even give the terrorist group all-out logistical and monetary support, hosting its meetings on their territories while speaking of human rights and world peace.
The Islamic Republic of Iran's Air Force has wrapped up the 11th edition of aerial drills codenamed Defenders of Velayat Sanctuary. During the 2-day nationwide maneuvers, Air Force units conducted a full range of operations and exercised various tactics using drones, fighter jets, transport, logistical, and refueling aircraft, as well as air ambulances. The operations were conducted over various areas from the Persian Gulf to the northwestern and northeastern regions. The main stage of the drills kicked off in the central province of Isfahan on Sunday night, as fighter jets and bombers carried out nocturnal operations and detonated the mock enemy's ground targets with Qasid-upgraded standoff missiles. The Iranian military drones also conducted major operations. Various combat, reconnaissance and electronic warfare UAVs such as Kaman 12, Karar, Mohajer 6 and Arash destroyed targets using different modified bombs with pinpoint accuracy. On the sideline of the drills in Isfahan, the chief of staff of the Iranian Armed Forces, Major General Mohammad Bagheri, hailed the Air Force for achieving the main objectives of the maneuvers, saying the country's military preparedness prevents enemies from taking any hostile action.
The Army's Air Force has provided a very suitable and acceptable level of security for Iran's airspace from the north to the Strait of Hormuz and the three islands of the Greater Tomb, Lesser Tomb, and Abu Musa. With this level of readiness, no enemy has the capability to penetrate and violate the airspace of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Major General Bagheri also said the power, readiness, and vigilance of the Air Force will constantly improve, promising a brighter future ahead. Iranian military experts and technicians have in recent years made substantial headway in manufacturing a broad range of indigenous equipment, making the armed forces self-sufficient. Homegrown Iranian military products have also found many clients in the world. Iranian officials have repeatedly warned that the country will not hesitate to strengthen its military capabilities, which are entirely meant for defense. This massive exercise is aimed at bolstering preparedness of the Iranian Air Force. It also serves as a clear warning message to the enemies of the Islamic Republic against any act of aggression. Mahdi Abbasian, Anorak.
The United States Federal Reserve raised the interest rate once again, reaching its highest level in 22 years, with no indication for when it will return to normal.
We'd be comfortable cutting rates when we're comfortable cutting rates, and that won't be this year, I don't think. Inflation remains well above a longer-run goal of 2%. Growth in consumer spending appears to have slowed from earlier in the year. Although activity in the housing sector has picked up somewhat, it remains well below levels of a year ago, largely reflecting higher mortgage rates.
Low consumer spending spells major trouble for an economy in which consumer spending provides 70% of GDP. The housing sector just saw its first price decline in 6 years, and housing is the primary financial asset for the average family.
A well-known byproduct of prolonged high interest rates is that it will cause precarious businesses to go bankrupt and provoke mass unemployment. Data shows this is already taking place.
Corporate bankruptcies just hit their highest first-half levels since 2010. Planned layoffs are at the highest first-half levels since 2009. The damage done by prolonged high interest rates is revealed by the highest level in years for credit card, car loan, and other debt, and all while still failing to reduce record prices for the most basic goods.
People are suffering from it, and a lot of more people are going to food banks to get food because they can't afford to buy a lot of the food. And also the government has cut food subsidies for people who in need.
Despite the economic hardship, Washington has ended key coronavirus-era programs, with health insurance just revoked for millions of people. States are reporting their first increases in years for their poverty rates, all of which contributes to President Joe Biden's near-record-low approval rating.
Yeah, they might cause Biden to lose the election because he's not doing enough about inflation. I'm sure he knows that. I mean, people are going to, whatever, if it's going to be Trump versus Biden or whoever, people are going to vote for where the economic situation, where they think it's going to be better. Because most people see the two parties as being the same.
There are other ways to curb excessive prices that don't burden the working class, such as price controls, limiting corporate profits, preventing price gouging, and increasing wages. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
During the first 10 days of the Islamic month of Muharram, culminating in Tasawwuf and Ashura, eulogists recite the events of the Battle of Karbala, and Islamic scholars elaborate on the underlying message of Imam Hussein's stance against tyranny.
Tasawwuf is the ninth day of the lunar month of Muharram. It is considered a very important religious occasion as Muslims worldwide commemorate the martyrdom anniversary of the grandson of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, Imam Hussein alayhi salam.
Ashura, which literally means the 10th of Muharram, is the day Imam Hussein alayhi salam and his 72 companions were martyred in the Battle of Karbala in southern Iraq in 680 AD as they fought courageously for justice against the much larger army of the Umayyad Caliph Yazid I. Imam Hussein alayhi salam is a hero that transcends time. His goodness makes him a moral example for all human beings worldwide, and foreign students at Tehran University have not missed the chance to mourn for the much revered Imam along with the entire Iranian nation.
We all gather here, irrespective of religion. We here in our Hayat a lot of students who belong to the different sects like Ahl Sunnah and other sects as well. They work for the love of Imam Hussein.
The very popular phrase, Hubbul Hussein Yajma'ana, this is the actual meaning of it, that everyone from around the world, no matter of their background, can come together and commemorate the martyrdom of Imam Hussein for one message, the message of Islam, the message of the grandfather Imam Hussein alayhi salam.
Participating in Hayat means like propagating the message of Imam Hussein, which is justice and unity.
Tearful mourners take part in rituals while educating the younger generation about the sufferings of Imam Hussein. The processions continue until noon. After the prayers, people line up for lunch. Many people consider it an honor to serve the lovers of Imam Hussein, and that is why they give away food not just to the needy, but also to those that have been taking part in the processions.
Cooking for a large crowd is very difficult, but we enjoy serving the lovers of Imam Hussein. It's an honor. Today we served about 3,500 meals.
The positive vibes that we get on this day is simply incomparable to any other experience.
The mourning rituals of Tasua and Ashura are considered an important part of Iranian culture, mostly because of the opportunity to reflect on Imam Hussein's values, his way of life, and what he stood up for. Gizumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
People in Afghanistan have been commemorating Muharram in large gatherings under the rule of the Taliban and amid security challenges. Tasua falls on the ninth day of the Islamic month and is devoted to Imam Hussein's brother, Abul Fazl al-Abbas. To mark the occasion, thousands of mourners converged on one of Kabul's oldest shrines. Participants expressed their affection and devotion to the martyrs of Karbala and honored their sacrifices.
The school of Imam Hussein taught us the lessons of heroism and freedom. Imam and his companions sacrificed themselves in the path of religion, justice, and truth. They stood for the future of Islam and humanity.
In all our processions, we witness both Sunni and Shia people actively taking part. They beat on their chests, recite elegies, and distribute food shoulder to shoulder with each other. This bonding and solidarity is getting stronger year after year as more and more people learn about Imam Hussein and his revolution.
On Ashura, Afghan Muslims closed their businesses and took a day off to grieve over the tragedy of Karbala. Here at Khatam al-Nabiyyin Mosque, people from different backgrounds observed Ashura as a common Islamic heritage. They emphasized the importance of Islamic unity in the face of global arrogance and condemned the recent desecration of the Holy Quran in Sweden and Denmark.
We can sum up the message in Gola Ashura in one sentence, and that is resistance against the arrogant and tyrannical ruler of the time. The Afghan people proved that they are the true followers of Imam Ali and Imam Hussein by fighting and defeating the Soviet Union, the British Empire, and the United States.
Insulting the Holy Quran in Sweden and Denmark is an act of hatred and enmity toward Islam and its high values. This heinous act was against all universal and human values, and this was an insult to the sanctities of about 2 billion Muslims in the world. We condemn this insult and want it stopped.
Muharram ceremonies in Afghanistan faced some limitations by the Taliban security forces this year. The Taliban authorities cited security reasons for the measures, but many Shia Muslims are suspicious of their motive. Ashura is the school of liberty and resistance against tyranny. The ceremonies held here show people have not forgotten the steadfastness and heroism of Imam Hussein and his companions hundreds of years after the tragedy of Karbala. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Bismillah. Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزایی لازم است.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن. از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran. Quran.
کتاب
of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among thy servants, of a handmaid from among thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask thee, O he who owns all objects of need, which are granted by his will and hastened to his desire, that thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willst, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Israeli protests, Israeli army reservists have stopped reporting for duty. But that is not the most important issue facing Israel. There's also growing divisions among the officials. Looking at the scenes of these protests, some have come to the conclusion that Israel is in a state of civil war. In this edition of the program, we ask, is that really the case? Well, what is for certain is that Israelis are in a state of anger, with some deciding that Israel is not even worth living in, based on a recent poll, opting to migrate out of the occupied territories altogether. Top of all this is what ratings agency Moody's has called significant risk looming over the Israeli economy. Let's discuss all of that with our guests. First, let me introduce them. Keaton Mansfield, journalist and political commentator, joins us from Austin, Texas. Also joining us is Jamal Juma. He's the founder and coordinator at Stop the Wall campaign, who joins us from occupied Ramallah. All right, welcome to you both. Let me first start with you, Keaton Mansfield, and ask you about this so-called judicial reform that's happening and the approval that has taken place at this point. Just give us, in brief, a synopsis of what has occurred that has continued now to up the anger of the Israelis who are out in protest.
Netanyahu is at risk or has been indicted, and so he and the Likud party about a year ago proposed this unprecedented overhaul of the judicial system that would basically castrate the entirety of Israel's Supreme Court, rendering Netanyahu and his party as a de facto single party state of Israel. And so initially when he proposed this, there was massive upheaval. A lot of the military reserves said that they would not report in for duty. The largest labor union and Israel threatened to go on strike and completely bring down the economy of Israel. And so Netanyahu backed up a little bit and has decided now instead that this so-called judicial reform will be passed in segments, in passed bit by bit. However, I think the effect will still be the same.
What's very perplexing and confusing, but maybe that's somewhat the aim at this point, where the ultimate goal here is that there won't be a judicial system that it can override cabinet decisions, and that basically this cabinet is going to have decisions made that it can follow through with, and it's not going to have that oversight or anything that can overpower it. Is that correct?
Yeah, I would certainly say so. Yeah, this is Netanyahu's, for his own personal motivations to avoid any sort of legal persecution, as well as it represents the rift between the more liberal and so-called progressive forces within the Israeli government and the hardline traditional forces that that Likud seems to represent. And so I think you kind of have a split between the more nationalistic Jews and the international Jews in the Israeli political system. Essentially, what Netanyahu is setting up to do is to launch a sort of perversion of the Sauline and the Davidic kingdom of the Israelites from, you know, 3,000 years ago by getting rid of the judicial system, getting rid of the judges, and replacing it where Netanyahu can call the shots. He can rule Israel as he sees fit. And for the rest of the world, this is of the most utmost urgency to stop.
All right, Joel and Juma, so you heard what he said, and if you agree with him, to rule the occupied territories, which has been given the name Israel, based on how he sees it. I mean, what does that spell for Palestinians? We know what this extreme cabinet has said. We know what their views are, as extreme as they are. At this point, leaves out, I guess, it gives them a green light to do what they want, doesn't it?
I think yes, and more than that, I think all what Netanyahu is doing, and he and also the fascist parties, the right-wing parties like led by Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, now is mainly to accelerate the annexation of the West Bank, which is going on the ground, by the way. Like, and it's like what the settlers is doing now, attacking the Palestinian villages and communities everywhere, particularly in the Area C, targeting the Bedouin communities, pushing them out from their areas. Like any, this year we witnessed 8 communities that has been left their places under the pressure of this fascist settlers backed by the Israeli army. So what they want from this judicial system is now to be in their hands to facilitate as quickly as possible this annexation and to remove any obstacle that can delay this annexation, because you know that this is from ideological point of view for this right-wing parties, that this is like an Israel from the Red to the Sea, and it should be a full sovereignty and shouldn't be a Palestinians have any identity in this land. They were creating this colonial apartheid system, now ghettoizing the Palestinians in the residential areas, while trying to the vast majority of the West Bank to be annexed to Israel, to enable them to control once and for all the whole area.
Sure.
So, yeah.
Okay. You mentioned settlers, and I have to ask you, Keen Mansfield, whether you see an association when it comes to settlers and the power that's been given now and promoted by this extreme cabinet, in terms of being not only aggressive against Palestinians, which they have been in the past and they've carried through, but also they have increased the call for violence against Palestinians, and how that may constitute with this terminology which has been used, which many are now acknowledging that is what's unfolding, and that's the civil war. Because they say that these settlers are going to attack Palestinians, which they are. They're going to use their weapons, which does not get confiscated after they've used it against Palestinians. There used to be a law, but now they've abolished that law. And my ultimate question here, if you see the connection, is what is this civil war notion? Are we looking at that unfolding right now?
Yeah, well, it goes farther than just an increase of Israeli settlements, civilian settlements, colonies in the West Bank. About a year ago, the head rabbi for Sephardic Jews in Israel went public with this map of Greater Israel, which essentially expands the borders to include the Sinai Peninsula, include all of Syria, all of Lebanon, all the way up bordering against Turkey. And so I think this is the drive for Netanyahu, is to completely cripple the Muslim powers in the Middle East. And as a response for that, he can proceed with having the Dome of the Rock completely destroyed, the Third Temple built, and of course, which spells the end of the world for the rest of us, the rise of the Antichrist if the Third Temple is constructed. So yes, this a civil war breaking out in Israel is probably the best thing that could ever happen for the rest of the world, because if Netanyahu, if Likud party gets its way, the entirety of the Muslim world will be crippled in a devastating war and another war of Israeli expansion, which needs to be avoided at all costs. And so ideally, Israel will overplay its hand, as it often does, and internal difficulties, internal problems, will lead to the end of this false state, this fake country that has existed since the 1940s. Hopefully we are going to see it within, ideally, the next year.
Well, there are many who are hoping that, but it's interesting that you bring that up, because many might not have even voiced it the way that you did. And Jamal, it's interesting that our guest there said that this civil war would be one of the best things for the world, especially the Muslim world, and in particular the Palestinians. So tell us if you agree with that, and put that into context for us, how that may benefit this area in the West Asia region that some refer to it as the Middle East.
Yeah, so far I can agree with this. The evidence is like this state that has been established in the 40s, it's established on racism. It is a deep racist country. It maybe mostly it's shown against the Palestinians, it's their racism, but like the Palestinians are most suffering from this. But as well, they are internally, they are a racist society. There is racism within the society itself, a domination of this white Zionist Ashkenazi that came from the background of the colonial powers in last century in Europe, and also the Eastern Jews. Then after that, also the African Jews, then the Russian Jews. Like, and so the levels of racism in this country is like so deeply rooted, and it's very high. So it's now a breakout. It's a breakout in the face of this state. So the cracks that's already there and the division in the society is really very deep. And this, I think it's irreversible. And how things is going now, it's leading to that. What we saw in the streets now, that could be developed like in the coming months to a street against the street, like the fascist and the right, what's so-called the right fascist Zionist against this, what would they call the secular racist Zionist. So the conflict within this has become much more deep. And there is also the cracks in the military, as we saw. Now there's almost like a kind of disobedience started. Like the other like important things that affect this state is the economy, which we see that there is so many companies now is taking out their capital, and they are not, yeah, they don't, they are afraid from continue investing in their country. So how we can expect also the international investment that they were promoting in the last decades? Also, they are now immigrating. So yeah, this state is now in deep crisis, and this crisis will be also in depth more in the coming coming months. And I agree, like this, they might be busy with themselves than launching like massacres and crimes in the either against the Palestinians in Gaza, West Bank, or against some neighboring Arab countries like Lebanon once in a while.
All right, some of the things that were mentioned there are important ones. I'm sure you agree, Keen Mansfield, which is pulling apart the seams of the Israeli society, from the economy to the military. And I'm going to ask you about the reservist issue, where there is now put in motion Either you have things where these reservists are signing up that they're not going to go through with their reservist status, that they're not going to volunteer any longer. I'd like to ask you how much of an impact that has on the Israeli regime forces altogether when you have this in motion and is set to really spread even further beyond the reservists. How does that affect Israel's security, in a sense?
Well, I would imagine that it is having a significant impact on the domestic tranquility of Israeli society. I mean, we know it is, because when this started, when Netanyahu was trying to ramrod this judicial reform through, he got so much pushback from the military, he had to back down, he had to break it up into segments. The tweaks were made to this so-called proposal, but at the same time, I'm very hesitant to go all in that it will be because of maybe younger and more liberal, more hip, more with the times kind of Jews that aren't willing to go out and just try to conquer Syria or try to conquer the rest of occupied Palestine. I very much hesitate to put too much hope into that being what stops Netanyahu from getting his way, because at the end of the day, we've seen this time and time again, when there's any sort of civil discourse and any sort of back and forth within the Israeli government, that even when it looks like it's getting to the breaking points, this apartheid operation of the Israeli state is going to collapse, those in the government and the civilians sort of say, well, you know, at the end of the day, we're all Jews, and so we may disagree with each other, but we have to be loyal to one another. Otherwise, these dirty Palestinians are going to get their way, and this Israeli project is going to fail. So I would say it's certainly good to see some pushback within the military, but you have to remember that this is the IDF, and to ever trust or have hope in the IDF doing what is right would be ignoring a pushing 100-year track record. So be careful, because the Jews, they will side with themselves before they let the Palestinians gain an inch. Okay. And so it's just a warning of caution, I suppose.
Sure. Well, this warning of caution that our guest there, Jamal Juma, is issuing, you would think that what he's saying, in a sense, does hold truth to it. But when you take a look at the protests, which, you know, we rummage through so many of these footages that are coming through from Israel, Jamal Juma, we're seeing people, it's not about the system, it's about the cost of living. People are angry. There's a lot of anger out there. And it's not just about these so-called judicial reforms. They're sick and tired of, especially the ones in Tel Aviv, about the cost of living being so high. They're sick and tired also on the political side of things when it comes to how Israel is never really able to maintain a solid security for its inhabitants on occupied lands. My question to you is, how deep are fissures in Israel where it is almost impossible for it to go back to the status quo of before?
You know, I think it's difficult, because here, the conflict is not on the just on the top level. You are talking about the conflict that has been in the whole society, in the two big bodies of the society. So I expect even if they reform that, this vote that was in the Knesset 2 days ago, I think we will find the crisis with the demonstrations. We will see these demonstrations that will start from the right wing parties in the streets. So the right wing parties now, that it was a golden opportunity that never dream of, that one day they will become and control the state and turn it into an ideological Jewish state. That's what they are now starting with, and they are not going to give up this easily. So they will fight for this, and that's what I think. What fears the Israeli people themselves, that's what I say. Why I say maybe we will find and that's how the polls is showing, that many people just feel insecure. Beside also that the expectation of the deterioration of the economy, if this major companies, especially from the high tech, started to leave, so that the economical situation will not be secure like any or good enough that, as it was. So what will encourage them to stay, especially when they talk about the security there? This state has built on a security. If the people feel insecure in this state, all what they were promoting to bring Jews to Palestine, that this is the secure place for them. And if they mm-hmm. feel that the security, they are not secure anymore, especially internally, from the situation internally, and they are afraid and they are expecting that this conflict is going to become much more confrontational between the streets and inside Israel. The military that they were that's supposed to be like this is like the main thing that bring them together and give them the security. And all the time they were proud of this military that undefeatable, that it's very strong, and it's the one who's controlling the rhythm inside Israel. And now there is a serious problem within this army. So there's so many problems on the security wise, economical wise, that will push many people to leave. I'm not talking about the mass immigration left there, but like this is will go gradually with the deterioration of the situation. And sure. As I said, because this is irreversible. What that has been done is irreversible. The division inside the society is irreversible. And everyone will be stand strongly behind what they want, either what the right fascist wing achieve now by this when they are in the government, or those like any door secular Zionists who were ruling the states in the last the last 7 decades.
All right. Keen Mansfield, our guest there says in terms of the he touched on something important here, which I want to ask you, and that's about the migration. Okay, first of all, the stat that we have, the most recent stat, which has made news, let me double check and make sure that I'm going to say this correctly. It's a new survey, that's a third of Israelis considering moving abroad, okay, based on this judicial reform bill. But I want to tie that in with the economy, of which, when you take a look at the shekel, Israel's money compared to the U.S. is devaluing 6% so far. Roughly, that's the average median. But what's more important, and people don't really realize this, I don't know if you do or not, but that's the high-tech sector. That's a big sector in Israel. In terms of the stats there, it employs 11% of all employees, responsible for 17% of Israel's GDP, and for 23% of overall direct tax receipts. That sector needs foreign money. It needs investments. There is no investor confidence right now. That sector is being decimated as we speak. And when that happens, you're going to get the migration out of Israel. So my question to you is, when you say don't have so much trust in the reservists, we're looking at an economy that's falling apart. And people are going to migrate out of an economy that's not doing well. No amount of security is going to buy an economy for Israel, if you agree. So are we looking at something, and based on the fact that the protested now for almost 8 months now, are we looking at this really putting a test to Israel altogether?
Well, I should certainly hope so. If you have a third of your population considering or having basically fled your country after your entire sales pitch for existence is a good, stable, and prosperous place for the Jews to go, and now you turn around and you have a third of the population on the brink of abandoning your state, you're going to be in a serious issue. You've lost literally a third of your manpower, which then raises the concern for me that oftentimes when countries start to have economic issues, when there's an economic downturn or there's the risk of one, or people are losing faith in the government, they feel insecure, they feel like their lives are endangered, the state very well may turn itself towards a war-based economy, Netanyahu or Likud party, or even if it were the more liberal, progressive, so-called secular Zionist forces, may see that the only real way to move forward is with some sort of mobilization of the IDF to sweep in and occupy the rest of Palestine, to drive every single Arab that they can find out of the West Bank, out of their rightful homeland
okay.
altogether.
Let me jump in, and I'm sorry to interrupt you because I got to squeeze one the last question due to lack of time to General Joma. If they decide to do that, what do you think Do you think maybe that would be actually a nail in the coffin if Israel decides to move in and do what our guest there just said in regards to Palestinians? Less than a minute, please.
Yeah, I think they are thinking of this, especially when we talk about Smotrich and his plan that has been launched. Yeah, they were thinking of this, but I don't think that this is easy now. Israel is not in its best cases to do such an amass like Nakba, like in 48 in the Palestinian area. The Palestinians much more stronger than that time, and Israel and internationally and is not as supported as it was in that time. So. And okay. It's not going to be something easy that they will do, and this will be the end for Israel. They can't export the problem with like a mass expulsion and of the Palestinian people.
Thank you very much. Sorry to break you there, but we're just out of time. Jamal Juma, founder and coordinator of Stop the Wall campaign. Keaton Mansfield, thank you, journalist and political commentator from Austin. Thank you so much. With that, we come to an end for this edition of the Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitale and the team, it's goodbye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
BRICS security cooperation emphasizes multilateral security and common security, which is greatly different from what the United States advocates. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Global Times noted, the increasing importance of the BRICS amid rapidly changing geopolitics is being reflected in the grouping's role in global security. BRICS national security advisors are meeting in the host country of South Africa as part of the build-up to the highly anticipated summit of the bloc next month. Political and security cooperation is one of the original objectives of BRICS cooperation, and it is also one of the pillars of the current BRICS agenda. The meeting of national security advisors and high representatives on national security serves as the main platform for the BRICS countries to discuss and carry out cooperation in the field of politics and security. The current global security governance is undergoing systematic shocks, with turbulent factors in the international situation increasing. The U.S. is creating an atmosphere of confrontation and tension worldwide, utilizing the so-called Indo-Pacific strategy and NATO to simultaneously encircle and contain China and Russia. Its aim is to maintain the old global order and the U.S. monopolizes. To achieve this, the U.S. regime has strengthened its various security cooperation mechanisms, coercing other countries to align with its interests. Song Zhongping, a Chinese military expert and TV commentator, told the Global Times that this approach is actually using a security mechanism to hijack the interests of others. In contrast, BRICS security cooperation emphasizes multilateral security and common security, which is greatly different from what the United States advocates. Zhu Tiangxiong, director at the Center for BRICS Political and Security Studies, Institute of BRICS Studies of Sichuan International Studies University, told the Global Times that the BRICS mechanism has different ways and methods from Western-dominated mechanisms when dealing with global and regional hotspots issues. The discussion of all issues, including security issues, by the BRICS countries is based on consensus. There is no so-called dominance, and everyone is on an equal footing. The solutions to specific problems are also different from those in the West. Western countries often impose sanctions or even use military means, while other BRICS cooperation peaceful methods such as promoting diplomacy, dialogue, negotiation, and mediation are used. This has provided new ideas for regional and global security. At the meeting of BRICS national security advisors and high representatives on national security, Zhu said, the Russia-Ukraine crisis is likely to be the focus of discussion, and promoting peace and talks will certainly take center stage. Now, the security differences between Western countries and emerging countries, including developing ones, are widening, and ideological disputes on a global scale are intensifying. In order to make the BRICS cooperation mechanism more long-term and developmental, corresponding security mechanism to ensure cooperation among BRICS countries must be established. This is also crucial for economic cooperation. Meanwhile, the deepening economic cooperation can in turn promote mutual trust among member states in their security cooperation. In the field of traditional security, some countries in the West have suppressed emerging and developing countries in various ways. At the same time, in the process of economic cooperation, developing countries also face constraints in non-traditional security, such as terrorism, extreme nationalism, and separatist forces. All of these hinder economic development. This is why the BRICS should strengthen cooperation in the field of security. The Global Security Initiative, put forward by China, advocates adapting to the changing international situation with a spirit of solidarity and responding to complex and intertwined security challenges with win-win thinking. It aims to eliminate the root causes of international conflicts and improve global security governance. This coincides with the multilateralism and common security pursued by the BRICS. Within the BRICS, although each country has its own national conditions, there is a broad consensus on jointly maintaining international security cooperation. Multilateralism is needed by emerging and developing countries. This is also the reason why more than 40 countries have expressed interest in joining the BRICS. It has a center petal force, which is to promote a multipolar world and allow emerging and developing countries to have more discourse power. Within BRICS, there is no one country that dictates and can erode the interests of other countries at will. In the early days of the BRICS, there were many voices bad-mouthing the prospect of the group, pointing out the different political systems, social systems, and ideologies of the member states. Experts say this is true. However, the way the BRICS has developed to this day and the way economic and security cooperation has steadily advanced under the mechanism show that those differences do not affect the unity and attractiveness of the BRICS and its role in the international system. This is the essence of multilateralism.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.